Welcome to another episode of the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. How's it going out there, Bitcoiners? Hope y'all are well. Before we get started today, I want to take a second to ask you to check out layer1btc.com for some great Bitcoin merch. Shout out to Nick Ward, who runs the show there. He's a great designer. There's shirts, hats, hoodies, mugs, stickers, so many designs to choose from. You can click on partners and choose Citizen Bitcoin to shop the merch that supports this podcast, including the default Keynesian Recovery Center design. Bitcoin is teaching us default Keynesians what money really is, and that is nothing short of revolutionary in this day and age. So that's layer1btc.com, all spelled out. Check it out. All right, let's get on to this. Ben Prentice is a Bitcoiner who, like myself, finally dove down the Bitcoin rabbit hole in 2017. Ben has been focused on the economic lessons of Bitcoin recently. He's consumed a lot of the Austrian economic source literature and has started distilling that down into some fire threads on Bitcoin Twitter. You can find him at Mr. Cool BP. That's at MRCOOLBP. I've been a fan of the two episodes he's done with his friend Colin on the Bitcoin Echo Chamber podcast, and was excited to get a chance to sit down with Ben and chat Bitcoin today. Just a couple of Bitcoiners talking Bitcoin. It's one of my favorite things to do. Hope you all enjoy it as well. Here we go. All right, I'm really excited to welcome Ben Prentice to the show today. Welcome, Ben. How's it going, man?
Oh, it's going really well. How are you doing, Brady?
I'm doing really well. I've been following you on Twitter for a little while now. You, I think, are an underfollowed Bitcoin Twitter account. And if you're not following Ben on Twitter, at Mr. Cool BP, you should definitely give Ben a follow. He's written some great threads. He's really thoughtful. He's really been studying Bitcoin and Austrian economics and stuff a lot lately and talking about it. He's recorded a couple of great episodes with Colin on the Heavily Armed Clown Bitcoin Echo Chamber podcast. I think there are episodes 14 and 23, if I remember correctly, something like that. A couple of really good episodes, and you can check those out as well. So yeah, we're going to get into Austrian economics today. I know that that's been a topic that you've really dived into lately. And we're going to talk about like inflation versus deflation. I want to get into that idea, those ideas, why governments have kind of chosen to inflate. Like it seems like this has kind of been a conscious collectively conscious choice on the part of our government. We're going to talk about like why they've chosen to do that. Talk about the monetization process of Bitcoin and what that might look like, what it has looked like so far and what it might look like into the future. Talk about the implications of long-term thinking, how like sound money really will change our culture and our society and our economy for the better by making us think more long-term instead of this sort of short-term, quarter-by-quarter economic thinking. Those are some fun topics to talk about, but let's just get started by hearing a little bit about why you were enamored by Bitcoin when you found it. Like, what in your background really kind of drew you to it? What was that sort of hook that Bitcoin, you know, got into you?
Oh, well, I think, you know, as a young person learning about the world, it seemed to me that, you know, despite massive progress in, you know, the way that we create things and, you know, production of amazing new technologies, it seemed like in many ways the world was getting worse. And I became rather cynical about the world, and I had trouble understanding why, despite all of this amazing progress and you know, so many of the people you meet are really amazing people, but you see them struggling, right? And it just never really made sense to me. You know, what was the why? And, you know, I had learned about a little bit about Bitcoin very early on. But you know, I certainly didn't grok it. You know, I certainly didn't really understand, I think, because I'm still struggling to do that now after, you know, more than a year of research. And
yeah,
I think that I'm starting to understand that it is a monetary phenomenon, and that it may be, you know, the key to reclaiming that progress that we are so due in society.
Yeah, so you ran into Bitcoin pretty early. Like, was it like on Slashdot or something?
Yeah, I think
you
said on Colin's podcast, Slashdot, right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know,
yeah, I was a big Slashdot nerd myself.
For sure, right? And so you probably knew about it back then too, but you know, you didn't buy it in 2009 or 2010.
No, not at all. No.
I understood it. I did see some of the arguments for it, but I understood it mostly as an anonymous e-cash, you know, just as a anonymous payments. And I was like, oh, like payments for drugs on the internet. That is actually interesting. But it was one of those, you know, I didn't really think it would work. And it's, I guess I didn't pay too much attention to it in the years to come, but you know, like many in 2017, I saw the price go up so much that I was like, what the heck is going on here? And I really had to dig into it. And that's when I fell
in love with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was kind of had an eye on it. Like I was aware of it for many, many years, but I just, it was a curiosity to me and something that would kind of pop into my consciousness in and out, you know, a few times a year, maybe. I even set up a Coinbase account, I think in like 2014 or 2015, had trouble getting my bank connected to it. I was like, screw this, you know, forgot about it. And then in 2017, it went back over the all-time high, and I was like, interesting, this isn't dead yet, you know? And so, and it was off to the races at that point. Then, you know, then I think, I think it's similar to me, similar to you. The hook for me really was this alternative economic paradigm or ideas that are sort of collected in the school of Austrian economics, which, you know, and I talk about this on the pod a lot about the idea of default Keynesianism, how we're all just really brought up to think like this is the way things are now. Government controls our money. We have a central bank. This fiat money system is just the way things are now, and it's better than what we had before. You know, and we're rest assured. We're all assured by these very wise, wordy economists. You know, and. You know, Paul Krugman is you know, always right, and the Federal Reserve will take care of us in a minute. They can handle it. Don't worry about it. You know, they got
right.
This.
Yeah,
and just the way things are now. Yeah,
I think that is such a key thing that we really need to get into. You know, the conversation, this default Keynesianism, and maybe it's just so well understood by so many Bitcoiners, but you've put a name to it, and I think that's so crucial. You know, that we've all just been raised, you know, I call it the tyranny of the status quo, but you know, that's a wordy way to say what you're trying to say, which is that we've all just been raised on Keynesianism. And that is the paradigm that right. We live under. And part of that paradigm is that deflation is bad. And Paul Krugman, outlines these arguments of why deflation is horrible, you know, and he says, people expect falling prices and they become less willing to spend. And there's an easy counter argument to that deflation can cause increased consumption because you're able to buy more things. So I mean, essentially, like I feel like a lot of the narrative of Keynes is based on logical fallacies, a network of logical fallacies, and Henry Hazlitt in Economics in One Lesson. Lays that argument out right at the beginning of the book, and he, you know, by ignoring other groups, we can help this one group, and it is in ignoring those other groups that we are, you know, ignoring the truth of what we are doing. We are ignoring the effects that our actions have, and that's really what Austrian economics is. It's not a bunch of calculations and interest rates and trying to decide what the proper money supply is. It is simply looking at the consequences of our actions. And Paul Krugman, the consequences of his actions is that he's become a very wealthy person and, mm-hmm. and won a Nobel Prize for his work. So, you know, I guess you have to follow the incentives there.
Right, exactly. Well, let's talk about the incentive there. Let's follow it, because it's, you know, it's something that most people haven't done or haven't thought about, and it's an important thought exercise. When I realized how closely the incentives of governments are with Keynesian thought, it made perfect sense. Basically, Keynesianism is giving credence to that conceit that we can control money better than some naturally occurring money or some market chosen money like gold has been throughout history, right? So the idea is, look, we've discovered economics and we understand how this stuff works now. And so we can actually control the money to prevent the, you know, normal business cycles from really wreaking havoc on our economy. We can sort of tame. So let's give an example here. 2008, we have a economic collapse, a financial crisis. And we understand pretty well how it happened: subprime mortgages, too much, you know, a credit bubble, all this stuff. There was systemic risk, and it builds up into bubbles, and you know they pop. And the response Keynesianism prescribes is the government needs to spend money now because consumers are pulling back from spending, right? And if we allow that to happen, this collapse in spending will destroy the economy, and it'll be last far longer and be far worse than if we just intervene now in various ways. And so in 2009, 2010, and the subsequent years, we intervened in many ways, including decreasing, you know, cutting, slashing interest rates. And we have negative interest rates in the European Central Bank, many countries in Europe. Japan has negative interest rates now. And we also, of course, printed a lot of money. We called it quantitative easing, which is another example of those kind of wordy ways that Keynesians sort of confuse the situation.
Yeah, it's a euphemism for printing money.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And there are long, long wordy articles out there that try to, you know, convince us that it's not printing money. There's literally several articles titled "Quantitative Easing is Not the Same as Printing Money." And they make an attempt in a very Keynesian way, you know, just this very academic way, very wordy, 6,000, 7,000 word articles trying to prove this point, but it's just not true. So yeah, that's the Keynesian prescription. You know, they use this kind of idea, this fear that if we don't do this, it's going to be way worse, right? And the politics of fear is very powerful. It's used in every aspect of our political world. What is the alternative? What would have happened if we had just let the system, you know, let, I guess, not cut interest rates, not printed a bunch more money? What would have happened, Ben? I mean,
well, first of all, you know, as Saifedean would put it, the idea that the government can come and fix 2008 is like calling the arsonist to come put out the fire, because it is exactly. The inflationary pressure of the increase in the monetary supply, which the Federal Reserve targets as a rule nominally, that the, you know, the credit boom happens in the first place, and then we need the contraction in 2008. So again, you're calling the guy that started the fire to fix the problem. Secondly, what would have happened, let's say that yes, you let the arsonist start the fire, but then you don't let him put it out. Well, what happens is a liquidation of malinvestment, which we didn't really see because of quantitative easing, which is rather interesting. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that the undue credit. There's a really good quote. Let's see if I can. I have it. I think I read right here. The necessary resources exist only in the imagination of businessmen who have mistaken more credit for more savings. So more credit isn't more capital. It is more credit. And right. It comes at the expense of diluting the supply of money of everybody else.
Right. Exactly. Right. So, I mean, what would have happened, right? Like you said, we would have liquidated these bad businesses, businesses that had made bad decisions and only been able to prop themselves up with the extension of credit that shouldn't have existed in the first place. And so the response was to extend more credit, you know, print more money, bail these people out. You know, we had one failure, Bear Stearns, but even that failed, like it wasn't really a failure. It wasn't allowed to go bankrupt. It was, you know, sold off to JP Morgan at a very cheap rate, basically. So JP Morgan actually benefited in lots of ways from what happened after the 2008 financial crisis.
And the reason they did is because they accumulated capital stock. So many banks weren't necessarily doing that, but JP Morgan has been very intelligent since the creation of the Federal Reserve, and they've been playing the game the right way this whole time.
Right. And as, you know, just a great illustration of kind of the next thing that we can talk about, this idea of how fiat money has destroyed our store of value quality of our money. JP Morgan bought Bear Stearns at an incredibly discounted price, and that negotiation for that sale was mediated in large part by the government, you know, by agents of the US government. And they got it as part of that purchase, a building in downtown Manhattan that Bear Stearns owned that was worth more itself than JP Morgan had to pay for the company. Right? Just that one asset that they inherited in that purchase, that this skyscraper in downtown Manhattan, was worth more than what they paid for the entire company. And the reason that that building is worth so damn much is because it's used by large corporations as a store of value. So what are the implications of using these assets, equities, real estate, art, jewelry, you name it, anything that is relatively scarce compared to fiat money for a store of value?
Well, you know, I argue that it disrupts the economic use of these assets, and also that it is an artifact of bad money itself. Essentially, that, you know, the government or Keynesians, I suppose, have convinced everybody that deflation is bad and inflation is good, so that they have, as I put it, taken the store of value feature out of money because, you know, God forbid people are able to save money. Or are even incentivized to do so. So now we have this paradigm that because they've usurped all money by instituting legal tender laws, which are legal monopolies on money production themselves. They have forced people to store their wealth elsewhere, and they're very forthcoming about this by saying that this is a necessary paradigm. Because if we don't force them to store our wealth elsewhere, there won't be enough investment and there won't be enough nominal GDP growth, I suppose. But what it has done now, if you really look at it, is that it has given access to the wealthiest among us to store value assets, which I call, you know, asset money. The wealthy have no problem accessing the store of value assets like real estate and stocks, or artwork, right? But the common man, I mean, you know, how many shares of Amazon at whatever $1,000 it is a piece can they afford to hold as a percentage of their money? You know, how many houses can they hold? What percentage of their wealth can be stored in real estate? And the answer for many of them, if not most of them, is zero or very close to zero. So what you get is the wealthiest among us, the wealthier you are, the larger percent of your wealth you can store in store value assets, which inflate due to inflation itself, right? Essentially, the poorer you are, the less ability you have to store your wealth at all. This is the slavery that is the modern paradigm.
Yeah, and it's absolutely insidious because it's hard to see. And, you know, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, you're a wage earner, which most of us are in this world, you know, you're just focused on trying to pay those bills, and maybe you have sort of one asset, maybe your house or a couple, maybe a car or something that sort of has some kind of longer term value, I guess. Although cars aren't really used as store value unless they're like collectible cars, you know, but houses certainly are, and real estate certainly is. So maybe you have that one asset that you may benefit from over time of it going up in value. So that's your kind of one store value investment that you have, and you're paying, you know, hopefully you have like a 15-year fixed rate mortgage. But as we saw that in 2008, you know, there's all this predatory lending practices that were happening on that front too. So that wasn't necessarily a safe store of value investment for a lot of people who were just normal wage earners either.
Well, not in that year, right? And I wanted to touch on this earlier. So if I can just jump in really quickly now, you know.
Yeah, go for it.
You were pointing to 2008 when they put out the fire, right? And that they fixed it, right, with QE. Well, that may seem like the case if you look at the metrics and, you know, look at, you know, GDP and, you know, unemployment and inflation and all that. However, this fails. Once again, we are ignoring certain groups, and it fails to realize that there were many people who had to sell their house around that time. And maybe, you know, maybe they were transitioning to retirement and couldn't buy a new house. They were trying to sell their store value asset and redeem it. And if they had to do it then, they needed to liquidate then. Well, then they lost a significant amount of value. And we just forget the, you know, millions of Americans that were in that case. And we just say, well, we avoided, you know, 2008. It could have been the Great Depression, and it wasn't. I mean, it wasn't the Great Depression. Again, we're ignoring the fact that, you know, those people lost real, real wealth.
Yeah. And how long, I mean, how long can this continue, right? This is the question. And that happened, like that brings to mind some version of that quote that we hear all the time on Bitcoin Twitter, which is the markets can stay solvent longer than, or what is it? The markets can,
Stay irrational longer than
irrational longer
stay
than
solvent.
You can stay solvent. Yeah, exactly. So, like, the corollary here would be that the government can likely print money a lot longer than, you know, we can imagine, basically. And the reason that can happen is that the United States is an extremely robust economy that is innovating a lot and producing a lot of value, right? So what inflation really is, you know, when you get right down to it, is essentially skimming off that value, right? That the economy is producing, that all of us are collectively producing, all of the innovation that's happening in the United States. It's another sort of just tax right off the top that the government gets to take, and then not just the government, but all of the people who are close to the Federal Reserve. So the large banks, the huge corporations who have access to borrowing this, you know, low interest rate capital, and then getting to benefit from it by investing it in these store value assets, equities, real estate that we've been talking about, and making money from that. So it's benefiting the top few percent of, you know, people in citizens in this country. And we can see that on the chart that you've posted on several of your Twitter threads, where the productivity has just continued to increase over the past 100 years or so at, you know, a pretty consistent rate. But then the wages that we're earning in response, or like in return for this productivity, have completely flattened since about 1970.
Yeah, right at the end of 1971, for some reason.
Right. What happened in 1971 that might have had that effect?
I don't
effect?
Know. What the WTF happened in 1971? Colin and I just started a little website, along the lines of that question. So you can go to literally WTF happened in 1971.com if you'd like to see somebody's charge. But in 1971, you know, in August of 1971, because somebody tried to point to it and say, oh, well, that productivity decoupling from compensation happened in 1972. I was like, well, it was in August of 1971 that Richard effing Nixon, I am not a crook, Richard Nixon, took the money off of the gold standard. He temporarily suspended the convertibility of gold in fiat dollars into gold, and forever changed the global monetary paradigm because everyone else was essentially forced to do that. He ended the Bretton Woods Agreement, an era of prosperity and an era of virtually no banking crises, virtually zero banking crises.
Amazing.
And he changed the world forever. So I've gotten all sorts of amazing responses to that thread, many of which are the Keynesians trying to give the counter argument. And I've heard all sorts of reasons that, you know, that these things happened that have nothing to do with the gold standard, allegedly, like, oh, it was the price of oil that skyrocketed in the 70s, or it was the decline of labor unions in the 1980s, which, by the way, labor unions are an artifact of inflationary monetary regime and do help mitigate that problem. So yes, getting rid of those certainly doesn't help. But again, they are the artifact of inflation itself, which I argue deflation is the thing we should be expecting. You know, and maybe I'm ranting a little too much here, but
no, not at all.
The whole goal of economic progress is to reduce prices, reduce cost, so you can compete with your adversary or compete with the firm across the street. So why do we expect now prices to go up? Well, because the government has told us that if we don't make the prices of everything go up, then nobody will invest and nobody will buy anything. So we no longer expect falling prices, but we should be expecting falling prices. You know, virtually across the board, not necessarily everywhere, but virtually across the board, and we don't see that because the Fed nominally targets inflation.
Right, and so we've seen the price of the consumer price index has gone up steadily. So the overall price index of all goods and services in the economy, there are some parts of the economy sectors that have increased at a much faster pace than the average consumer price index, like education, healthcare. But there are also some sectors where prices have decreased over time. Like we've seen deflation happen. Namely, the electronics industry or, you know, computing industry. Why does that happen? Why are there some sectors of the economy and just the economy overall is generally prices are increasing for consumers, but there are some sectors that are showing deflation.
Yeah. I have to give a shout out to at Dieter Bob, Ah Ye Bitcoin, I think is his name. He messaged me after I wrote that thread on inflation recently. And he said, well, you know, how could you have written this thread without referencing Moore's Law? Moore's Law, if listeners aren't familiar, is just the idea that the amount of transistors doubles, every, I think, 2 years or something. Essentially, it's exponential growth in the computing power that we see.
Named after Intel co-founder Gordon Moore.
Thank you. Because of this exponential growth in computing technology, it has translated to exponential growth in productivity, or not productivity, it's exponential downward pressure on the price of electronics, and you know that that affects many other many other products that are kind of tied to that, namely automation and some other things. But what I'm trying to say is that despite this Federal Reserve target of and I keep using this word nominal target of inflation because it's based on the CPI, which is this basket of goods and services that we buy. And it you could think of it like kind of like an average of what the things we buy are. So, they're trying to target that the prices will rise by, a specific amount. And the exponential growth in electronics and stuff is putting an exponential downward pressure on those prices, so they have escaped inflation. They are priced downwards, much despite the fact that money is being printed because they're not printing exponentially more money. I don't know. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. Yeah, it's happening. it's happening despite the fact that everything else is inflating, and that because we're printing a bunch of money. That just shows the deflationary power of exponential technologies, which it's kind of amazing that it's happening despite all of this inflation.
And he interestingly said to me, Dieter Bob, that essentially it's because of this Moore's Law phenomenon, this exponential growth in electronics, that they have been able to play this game so well for so long, and that, you know, as Moore's Law breaks down, their game might be up. And I think it's really interesting. It's something I'm still musing on, but figured I'd throw it in there. So shout out to Dieter Bob for reaching out to me.
Yeah, that's an interesting path to go down for sure. So this is not like this whole phenomenon, this whole drama that has transpired over the past 100 years or so in this country and in the world. The fact that we created the Federal Reserve, we then created the Bretton Woods Agreement, which essentially after World War II, which essentially got all of the world's kind of global economic superpowers to agree to move from gold as sort of the global economic base money to using a gold-backed dollar, US dollar, as this global base money. And then in 1971, Richard F. Nixon decouples the dollar from gold. So, and as Pierre Rochard has been pointing out over the last couple of days on Twitter, this is not, we shouldn't really call this the dollar anymore. The dollar died when the Federal Reserve was created and we had Federal Reserve banknotes that were redeemable for dollars. And now we have what we should be calling Federal Reserve notes or fiat money. We can, as we kind of colloquially call it in the Bitcoin community. So we've been through this drama over and over again, right? Like this has happened over and over throughout human history. This is not like the first time that this has happened. Governments are, or some central authorities, monarchs, whatever sort of central governance system has developed in whatever part of the world throughout history, has succumbed to the temptation to inflate the money. Do you have off the top of your head a couple of good examples in history from some of your reading? I know there's some good examples in the Bitcoin Standard and maybe some of the other Austrian economics source texts that you've been reading.
I think, you know, the temptation to print money is not hard to understand. That's actually very simple. You know, being able to create the most important commodity on the planet, at will is rather tempting. And humans are, you know, are fallible, and we succumb to temptation, you know, many times in our lives. But there's a great quote from Ethics of Money Production by George Weedle Holzman, where he says, "Princes blushed when they were caught debasing, you know, their currencies. Modern mm-hmm. politicians can keep a straight face and justify inflation with the alleged need to stabilize the price level and to finance growth." So the difference today is that they've just convinced us that it's a good thing. You see, yeah. I mean, this, yes, as you say, for sure, money debasement has been happening for centuries, you know, if not right. a millennia, you know, because we've had
right.
coinage for quite some time. But that, you know, that was a very costly endeavor. You had to recall the coins, you had to melt them down and make new ones. And if people figured out what was going on, again, you know, the princes blushed. So the real trick was convincing everybody that it was a good thing. And this ideal of stabilization, you know, I think this is one we could dig into really quickly. Stable prices. I keep hearing them talk about that, that we need stable prices. It's like, well, wait a second, but electronics aren't stable prices, you know. They're going down, you know, and, you know, housing and medical, and that's not stable. Those are going way up. So where's the stable prices? Oh, well, they'll tell you that it's in aggregate as the CPI is relatively stable. But I'm trying to tell you that stable prices are not desirable. You know, we want the price of things to be falling, and that should be expected, again, as we get better at creating them. So this whole, you know, all of this really stems from the idea that we're afraid of deflation. And I think what everybody points to is the Great Depression, because, you know, it was a terrible event in modern history. And really, what happened then was extreme deflation and very unexpected deflation. You know, the Federal Reserve had just been enacted some 15 years earlier, and they increased the supply of money beyond the trend at the time, you know, partially due to the wars. And it was that contraction of the money supply. It was the redeemability of gold that they point to as the problem. But I'm pointing to the problem being that they inflated the money supply beyond the gold in the first place.
Right.
So
yeah.
They convince us all that deflation is bad, but it was their you know, mal control of the supply of money in the first place that caused the issue. So once again, it's the arsonist telling you, you know, how we should be putting out fires.
Yeah, yeah. There was this Hayek quote that kind of sums up this whole idea really well. He wrote that, or maybe he said it, I'm not sure. I do not think that it is an exaggeration to say history is largely a history of inflation. Usually inflation's engineered by governments for the gain of governments, right? And that just gets that idea that, you know, throughout history, we've gone from something like coin clipping. This is a little interesting tidbit that I learned recently, like
the ridges.
The reason that coins had were ridges were added to the edges of coins is because people were literally shaving off minute portions of, you know, coins that contain gold and silver and other valuable precious metals, and then kind of collecting those shavings and fashioning their own coins or whatever they did with them. And you can find pictures of coins that have these sort of like flat kind of edges that have developed from people literally clipping them.
Yeah, and so the coin got so small that it was, you know, a tenth the size of it. It was like, wait a second, this isn't the right size for a quarter.
That ain't right. Yeah. So, you know, this practice is, and that was, you know, people would do that kind of on an individual basis too. But, you know, there were several examples from the Roman Empire that this was just sort of a practice that was done by the central authorities, by the emperors, as kind of a way to tax the populace without having the frustrations of, you know, having to employ tax collectors to go out and badger people for their taxes, right?
Yeah, that sounds unpopular. It's almost as if you're saying that people always try to inflate money. So, if only there was some kind of money that we just couldn't make more of, you know.
Interesting. Some sly roundabout way.
Ooh, yeah. That's
as Hayek also said to kind of take back this money. Yeah, I think about that quote all the time. And how just it amazes me how prescient that quote was, right?
Yeah.
And he knew that was the only way it was possible. He didn't know how that would possibly happen, right?
but he knew that the only way we would have cleared money again is if, by some sly roundabout way, we could find a way to make a money that you couldn't make more of.
Yes. That humans couldn't make more of.
It would be great if we teleported around the world instantly, too, you know?
It'd be pretty cool. Yeah, maybe if it like worked on the internet, that would probably be a good way to use the internet.
I think you got something here.
Yeah. So, why is Bitcoin not inflatable? Like, what makes it not inflatable? What's the most important aspect of Bitcoin when you get right down to it? Obviously, there's lots of answers to this question, but what's the most important quality of the Bitcoin network and system that allows that has created this money that can't be inflated?
Well, I think
in your opinion,
most people say it's this social contract, the immutability of its monetary supply, and that, you know, let's say we call him Blodger Ray Vare or something, comes along and says, "Hey guys, come with me. I know, you know, I just heard about Bitcoin and I'm here to fix it. And all we have to do is introduce some, you know, inflation." And all the hardcore Bitcoiners would be like just laughing, you know, and he'd probably convince a bunch of people and they'd go and they'd create Bitcoin Smash or something like that. And I unpack this a lot, you know, especially if you're extrapolating into the future where there are large Bitcoin banks, you know, as Hal Finney kind of mentioned and Nick Carter has talked about. you know, who would be controlling the actual Bitcoin network at that point? And that, you know, could inflation be introduced, you know, later on when, you know, when we're all just transacting on the, you know, fourth and fifth, you know, Lightning Super Plus networks that we don't have, you know, we're not actually sending, you know, UTXOs from one place to another. But I think that that fails to understand how protocols develop and how protocols become immutable once they become widespread, right? Like, so, like, you know, if I just came along and said, hey, guys, everybody, I've got a great idea. Let's change HTTP protocol. You know, how, you know, even if it was a massive, massive improvement, everybody would be like, what the hell are you thinking? You know, you can't convince, you know, billions of people to change their, you know, to all update their devices in unison to support your, you know, your marginal improvement on some things. So I think that's a really long roundabout way of answering your question, but it's, you know, that we see it simply as the immutability of its monetary policy. And it's not a
yeah, and I guess what I was trying to get at, or I was trying to lead you, you know, is like the reason that it's immutable is because it's decentralized, right? Like that's the one quality. That's what I always end up coming down to.
Oh, did I lose you?
Oh, are you still there?
Hello? Can you still hear me?
Hello, hello. Oh, we got disconnected, didn't we?
Yep, you're back now though.
Oh, there we are. Okay, cool. Not sure what happened. Internet.
Decentralized.
Right. Yeah. That's where I was. Yeah. Where I was trying to sort of lead was, or at least my answer to that question, I think, is the decentralization is the key to immutability, right? To the fact that we can't inflate the supply, and the fact that we can't change the protocol, right? Which I think is also important, right? But yeah. So that's basically what it is. Is it comes down to the fact that we have a decentralized protocol that is being checked by, what, 100,000 plus nodes all around the world. And just like BitTorrent, which was this P2P network, was sort of the final piece of the puzzle, right, for Bitcoin to be invented. There were several attempts at creating money for the internet, native digital money, but couldn't get around the problem of the, you know, this is called the Byzantine generals problem, the double spend problem, without a central server, a central authority. And we saw Napster get taken down because it used central servers to distribute these files. And then Bram Cohen introduces BitTorrent, which is a decentralized version of Napster, which couldn't be co-opted, right? And so that was the kind of final piece of the puzzle. And I think BitTorrent was launched in like 2002, 2003. 5 years later, Satoshi has kind of worked out how to use this BitTorrent-like peer-to-peer network to solve the problem of the central authority in solving the double spend problem. But that also was the answer to creating a money that was inflation resistant and with a monetary policy that was unchangeable, because there's literally no central authority, which is the monetary system that we've been living under for a long time. And the reason gold failed and the reason we've seen debased currencies over and over again throughout human history is that some central authority takes control of the money supply and debases it because it's irresistible, as we talked about. So yeah, when I hear like altcoiners, and when I was kind of trying to figure out what's going on here through 2017 and early 2018, before I really kind of became, I guess, what I would have to call a Bitcoin maximalist, is that the quality of Bitcoin and the Bitcoin network, or what matters the most, is decentralization. And we must prioritize that at all costs, because that's what's providing the real value, the real protection against the eventual debasement of the Bitcoin monetary supply.
Yeah, and it also protects against it being shut down.
Right. Yeah.
Just like
exactly.
like BitTorrent itself. It's not just protecting the monetary supply. I think it's protecting the legal suppression. Right. You know, there's the Hulsman, who George Guido Hulsman in the Ethics of Money Production goes over four different factors that have allowed governments to take this monopoly on money production to keep it. And he says, you know, legalize falsifications, legal monopolies, legal tender laws, legalize suspension of payments, and they're all really the same thing. It's this, the government being able to dictate, you know, how money works. But Bitcoin obviates all of this. It cannot be inflated. It cannot be legally suppressed. You know, I'd like to see some governments try. I do not want to see my government try, because I think that it would put us behind. But I think yes. The most dystopian governments will likely try. And I think that is the case, because the most dystopian governments are the ones that, you know, stand to lose the most, the ones that have the stranglehold on their citizens. And that is where we can see, you know, local Bitcoin's volume. We can see it going crazy in places like Venezuela, Argentina, Turkey, Iran, Russia, China, all of these places. And I wouldn't put it past, you know, many of those governments to try to ban this thing. You know, America is a really interesting place, and I always have the American lens, so I do apologize for our international listeners. But you know, this has always been a place of freedom, and yet we did
well, at least give good voice to the fact that we you know, want it to be a place of freedom.
Well, yeah.
In practice, it's certainly not always been that way. But yeah.
I think the founding fathers, you know, in general, had some really interesting ideas that were that were probably better than what was around at the time. I'm not saying that the United States government is what everybody should use. I just think in general that we do try to protect the liberties and freedoms of people. And it would be very sad to see, you know, them come down on this. But, you know, I think, you know, this week is a really interesting time to talk about this, because we saw, you know, U.S. congressmen coming out and saying that, you know, this is an unstoppable force, and that, you know, that this innovation, it shouldn't be suppressed. So at least there is somebody, you know, in Washington seeing that there is something here. And this conversation is now starting to happen at a national, at a governmental level, you know, at a corporate level. It's what a time to be alive, dude.
Yeah, right. And that was at the Libra hearings, I think, right? Yeah. And there was a congressman. Yeah. And he was going back and forth with Milton Demers. And that was when the word shitcoin got entered into the record of the U.S. Congress for the first time. Which was amazing. The same congressperson was like, yeah, there's Bitcoin and there's shitcoin. Can you tell me about this, Mr. Mirrors? You know, and she's like, yeah, I got that. And then he called Bitcoin an unstoppable force. And of course,
I think that was a different gentleman. The unstoppable
was force, it? Okay.
Know, it was Patrick McHenry for sure.
Okay,
I don't remember.
Got you. Okay, so yeah, two different guys. I think. I think the shitcoin congressperson was a different guy. I don't think his name was Patrick. I think his name was Mike something. Yeah, but it was just great to see it, like, you know, in that Libra hearing, because of course this kind of centralized attempt at a pseudo cryptocurrency that Facebook is trying to get the government approval for is obviously centralized and obviously stoppable, right? Pretty easy, much more easily than Bitcoin. And the, you know, it's up for debate whether or not Bitcoin actually can be stopped. I do think let's get into this a little bit. I have a couple questions here. First of all, you know, what do you think states will do in the next decade or so? I mean, I don't think we've really seen a concerted state level attack on Bitcoin yet. Could be wrong about that. I know that actually I remember one of the Congress people in the Libra hearings did say something to the effect of, you know, Bitcoin, I think it was the Patrick McHenry, right? In the same bit where he called it an unstoppable force, governments that have tried to stop it have failed. And it was almost like he had some information, right?
Yes.
that we might not have.
Oh, I didn't even consider that. I thought he was talking about like in China where they kept like, they'd ban it like every 6 months or something like that.
Right. Yeah. But maybe, I don't know. I was like, that was sort of my conspiratorial thinking coming to the fore there. But like, yeah, he was, my thought was maybe he knows something. Maybe there's some intelligence that we don't know about. Yeah. What do you think will happen over the next decade from states? Do you think that liberal democracies are more likely to attack Bitcoin or more likely to sort of legalize it or accept it over time than sort of, you know, I guess more authoritarian states?
Well, I think the same thing that is happening today will continue to happen. Some governments are trying to ban it and some governments will actually embrace it. And, you know, Japan, what an interesting economic place that is. But for whatever it's worth, they've declared it legal tender. And we know Malta, I've talked about Malta before, is at least embracing the businesses and allowing them to come there. And I think offering some tax benefits or something like that. And, you know, we've seen China and we've seen, I think, Iran try to ban it. And I think we've seen Venezuela confiscate mining equipment, but I don't think they've actually banned anything. So I think you're going to continue to see that. And I think that some governments, you know, some more governments will ban it and maybe successfully and maybe not. But really, I think that just drives, you know, it drives the gains to other places. And I think the place that really embraces it for real is the place that will come out on top. Whether that place is just random people hiding on the internet or if it's an actual, you know, nation state. It's very interesting, for sure.
Yeah, after seeing, like last year, we saw Giancarlo, I think he was the head of the SEC or the CFTC, I can't remember which one, talk about Bitcoin in a very positive light, talked about how his daughter holds Bitcoin, etc. The couple of Congress people who were very bullish on Bitcoin and understand there's a difference between Bitcoin and shitcoin and called Bitcoin an unstoppable force in the, you know, on an official congressional hearings, makes me think that in a, you know, more of a liberal democracy type government, Bitcoin has a very good shot at becoming fully legalized in maybe a relatively short time, because simply the astounding incentive system of Bitcoin will incentivize it to happen, right? I mean, I'm guessing that those Congress people hold Bitcoin or know somebody who do, or maybe on their behalf or something. I don't know. They definitely sounded like, you know, people who are incentivized because they were holding Bitcoin to defend it, you know, and champion it in this, you know, incredibly amazing way on the floor of the U.S. Congress.
Right. And are they the Trojan horses, or are they just, you know, forward-thinking individuals? We don't know. And for what it's worth, I have the names of those politicians right here.
Thank you.
The one that was speaking with Meltem Demirez is Warren Davidson. So he's the shitcoin guy. Kevin McCarthy also talked very interestingly about Bitcoin. I think talking about the innovation that we shouldn't crush. Tom Emmer spoke at the House Financial Services Committee about Bitcoin. And of course, Patrick Mahenry, the world that Satoshi Nakamoto built is an unstoppable force.
Do you have the party affiliation for those guys up there by chance?
I think Patrick Mahenry is Republican. I would have to... Minnesota. No, I don't have them handy. I can look them all up, but...
Yeah. I'd be curious to know if they were on both sides
of the
aisle.
Kevin McCarthy is a Democrat. So I think there is some on both sides already. So that is, you know, money is a nonpartisan issue, and so is inflation. That's a nonpartisan issue.
Exactly.
I've heard people be like, you know, when I've talked about inflation, they're like, oh, well, that was, you know, all Reagan, or that was, you know, Nixon, or that was, you know, Barack Obama or whatever. It's like, listen, inflation has been happening pretty regularly and increasingly, you know, since 1913.
Yeah. Looks like Davidson is a Republican from Ohio. And I believe you can pay your state taxes in Ohio. Bitcoin.
Yeah, but I think they just essentially use like BitPay. So they just dump it to fiat.
Yeah. They dump it to fiat. But that's a good step in the right direction. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm thinking more and more that as over the next couple of decades, as Bitcoiners take office, there will be bipartisan agreement that we should, you know, encourage the flourishing of this free market money, especially if we can demonstrate its value as sound money. And Bitcoin is teaching people what money really is. That's what it comes down to. Keynesianism doesn't treat money the way, or look at money the way it actually is. It treats it as some sort of power, tool of power, right? And money is not that. It's just a simple, you know, good that we arrive at, the market arrives at, agrees upon, is the best to solve the problem of barter, the problems of barter, which is called by economists the coincidence of wants. Like, you may, you know, we don't all have the same wants and needs at the same time. We need some sort of intermediary to solve that problem, and a way to effectively store your value over time. That's really all it is. And we've arrived at that agreement in the open market over and over again through human history as being gold. And we understand through Austrian economics, teaching us that why that is, gold doesn't tarnish, all the gold that we've, almost all the gold that we've harvested from the earth's crust over the past 5,000 years still exists on the surface of the earth, has a very high stock to flow ratio. It only increases 1.5% or so per year. And that's been pretty stable throughout history. So all of those reasons, Satoshi modeled Bitcoin after this, the most sound money we've known, and created an even more sound money, right? I've gotten a lot more optimistic about the probability that Bitcoin will be accepted by liberal democracies throughout the world over the next couple of decades. Just in this past week or so from those Libra hearings.
For what it's worth, I did look it up really quickly, and all of those guys are Republican.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
We're waiting for that Democrat Trojan horse to reveal himself, I suppose.
Well, Brad Sherman is a Democrat.
Oh, God.
And he hates Bitcoin.
He's not a fan, so, from what I understand. He wants to ban it. Right? Just to go to what you were just saying, an increase in the money supply, like an increase in the supply of any good, lowers its price. The change does not, unlike other goods, confer a social benefit. Money is only used for its exchange value. That's a Rothbard. And you mentioned wanting to talk about the idea that money must be a good used in the economy first. And I think that's such an interesting one, because so many of these Austrians really wouldn't agree with Bitcoin because they think first that it must be a commodity that becomes widespread and then takes a store of value. I think there's been some discussion on why, they may have missed the mark on this. Did you want to try to get into that? I still like mess around with it a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think one way to easily understand this is that the commodity's use in the industry is what actually makes it hard to be a money, I think. Or conversely, you can say that you using gold as money really inflates the price of gold because of people's willingness to hold it. So therefore, our use of gold in industrial usages, like in electronics and ASIC miners, as Peter Schiff has pointed out, is disrupted by our use of it as money. So if it is such a valuable commodity that it becomes so widespread in its use that people hold it and then becomes money, well, then this valuable commodity we've now relegated to be sitting in vaults, in the case of gold, and really driving up the price of that and sequestering all of that really useful commodity that could be used in production of much cheaper ASICs or, much cheaper computers and stuff. So just a quick dissection of it, but.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, and I don't understand at all that argument. It doesn't make any sense at all. And maybe it came about at a time before we had the possibility of Bitcoin, and that the idea that, you know, there could possibly be some commodity that is only used for money could possibly exist, yeah. Right?
Actually, Hulsman touches on this. I have another quote. Unless you wanted to finish that.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think you're exactly right, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the monetary premium on necessary goods and services and like assets like real estate or equities or whatever in businesses that is created by fiat money, and it creates a massive inefficiency because we shouldn't be using real estate for money for store value. We shouldn't be using real estate for store value. We should be using real estate to protect us, shelter us, give us a home to live in. And that's it. And so, you know, especially this is felt in larger cities where the demand for real estate is much higher than, you know, mid-size, you know, towns and cities or whatever. But, you know, there are entire apartments and houses and condos all over this world that sit empty for most of their lives. Because they're literally just an investment, a store of value. That's all they're used for. And that's just makes no sense. It drives up the prices for everybody else, for a necessary good and service. So yeah. And same thing with gold. Like, we just don't need to use gold as money.
So their economic uses are disrupted, just like in the case of gold. Right. And that is a detriment to society because, you know, there are people in New York that want to actually live in these houses that can't afford them, that nobody's living in them. Right. So, The paradigm is not beneficial to society. It is detrimental.
Right. And then builders will be are incentivized to go and build these gorgeous, you know, condos in downtown Manhattan that are going to get bought up, not to be actually used to live in, but just to store value and pass it down, you know, in their family.
And that, my friends, is called malinvestment.
Malinvestment.
Investing in something that is really not sound, right? So I found this. So the quote is talking about how paper monies are only able to proliferate due to the government enforced monopoly on them, right? Because they are not actually good money, you know? It is the government propping them up, this Gresham's law that drives the good money out of circulation, that allows them to exist in the first place. Without a legal tender law, we'd probably still be using gold. Gold, interesting because, you know, it isn't transportable across the internet. So he goes on to say, an economic good, so this is the quote, right? An economic good that is defined entirely in terms of bits and bytes is unlikely to ever be produced spontaneously on a free market for the very same reasons we discussed in the case of paper money. So he thinks that it sounds to me like he's saying that we'll never be able to create a money on the internet that you know, of bits and bytes that you can't create more of. So it's almost like he's capitulated already. And he goes on, and despite the dedicated efforts of various individuals and associations, no such money has ever in fact been produced since the creation of the internet made electronic payments possible. At present, only government money has been produced in electronic form. And as in the case of paper money, governments could do this only because they have the possibilities to suppress competition. On a free market, the new information technologies have been unable to create any new monies. They have been able to develop various new instruments to access and transfer money. These new electronic techniques of dealing with money are very efficient and beneficial, but they're not to be confused with the creation of electronic money. This was written in 2008.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing.
So it's he was so close to seeing it, right? Like he's dancing around the issue of it so closely, but I mean, a lot of us failed to understand that you could create a digital thing that you couldn't create more of.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was impossible before Bitcoin. I mean, that digital scarcity was invented, you know, and put in and given to us January 3rd, 2009. That was a 0-to-1 moment in human technological history, a profound one, as I think you and I have, and most Bitcoiners have arrived at, and I think it just the how exactly how profound it is hard to understand. And I think I understand it a little bit more like every week that passes by, you know? And I just keep getting more and more convinced and convicted and bullish about Bitcoin's future, because it has delivered on this promise that Holzman is talking about there, that we have created, the free market has produced a digitally native money that is going to replace, that's better than any money we've ever had and is going to replace any money that we have now. It's just going to take time. One last, that leads perfectly into this kind of last bit that I want to talk about before we jump off, but I want to talk about the monetization process of Bitcoin, and you wrote a good thread about it. Let's just jump into it. Can you kind of recap that thread for us, which sort of looks back at the first 10 years of Bitcoin's monetization process, and then maybe we can kind of project forward on what the next couple of decades might look like?
Oh, yeah, sure. So what would it look like if a revolutionary open digital commodity was being monetized in real time? This is like literally unfathomable to anybody because, first of all, even these Austrians have been thinking about sound money for so long and thinking about digital sound money. There was Milton Friedman talking about a reliable e-cash. There was Hayek talking about the sly roundabout way. We've been thinking about this for so long, and yet they failed to understand that it would be, you know, such a 0-to-1 moment when we created a money that could not be inflated on the internet. That even economists and historians and politicians would have no idea what the hell was even happening. And I went on to say it might look like this, and I talked about volatility would have to decline, right? So volatility is an important component of monetization because, well, in monetization, it is the acquisition of a monetary premium of a good. So in order to acquire a monetary premium, what the price does actually have to go up. And in this case, it had to go up from zero. So that is happening. And if you look at the volatility over time charts, they do show a downward trend. And I go on to talk about, you know, we'd need ways to scale this thing. And you look at the Lightning Network has seen kind of exponential growth. This idea of the fact that it's open, I think, is really interesting too, because you have these open developers who are they themselves open. You know, I've reached out to a lot of these guys and I reached out to you and you can chat with them and DM with them and they're usually very helpful. It's like Pierre Richard. I'm sure he's swamped, but you know, he's got a little Telegram chat for his node launcher, which is, you know, all this stuff is open source, and the extensibility of Bitcoin itself, I think, is such a key component of the fact that this is, I mean, people say Bitcoin can't scale. You know, Andreas talks about that scaling is a lose, you know, you're always failing to scale. It's infinitely right. Scalable. We just can't see it yet, right? The fact that Bitcoin is, you know, intrinsically tied to its second layer, unlike gold, you know, gold, we scaled gold. We scaled gold through paper money. It was, you know, the separation between those two things was a stroke of a pen. The separation between the Lightning Network or the Liquid Network and Bitcoin, not so easy. Maybe more so in the case of Liquid, but not in the case of Lightning Network. It's, you know, all cryptographically tied. And I went into the economic underpinnings for its monetary policy would require foundation, and I linked to the Mises Institute. So, you know, if you guys aren't reading Austrian economics, I don't think you're really going to get the economic picture of why Bitcoin monetarily is an unstoppable force. I think the work that has been done in the past, you know, like the Nakamoto Institute, there's so many good writings on there. Some from Pierre Richard, actually, Nick Szabo's on there. Incredible stuff. But we've even seen amazing content come out in the last year. You know, Dare GG has the 21 lessons is incredible. And you've seen the proliferation of a lot of these, compilations of resources and the podcasts like yourself, like yours. I mean, I found your podcast, and your idea of default Keynesianism, I think, is world changing. I ended the thread saying, you know, demonetization of Bitcoin may not look like we expect, but then again, it might. I don't know.
Yeah. It's, and it, it well, I was going to say something on scalability. We have seen a little bit about like what kind of a sneak preview of what scalability might look like in terms of or like in the way we scaled the internet. And you know, in the 90s when the web was born, there was like no way that we could fathom that we could stream like HDTV over the internet. Like TCP/IP just couldn't handle it. The bandwidth wasn't there. The infrastructure wasn't there. You know, Netflix when it started was actually like actually shipping DVDs through the mail because they literally could not like stream movies over the internet like that for the, like, that just wasn't scalable enough for them. Like you may be able to do it for a small number of customers, but it just wasn't scalable for the kind of the large business they wanted to build. But they knew it would be eventually. They saw the writing on the wall. They saw how the internet was scaling and the web was scaling. You know, and so all of that technology got built out over time by the free market, and we've got, you know, incredible scaling that's still happening. 5G is coming online, and that's going to bring, you know, 4K streaming to your phone, you know, like to everybody's phone. So yeah, and we're doing the same thing. We're taking the layered approach, and these protocol developers, they're some of the best in the entire world that are working on Bitcoin.
It's really funny that you mentioned, you know, like the early 90s internet, because you know, I was I was a young boy in the 90s, and my dad was a software programmer and had all sorts of computers in the house, and you know, I remember I think it only took me a year to understand exactly what the internet was, because the first year I used it, we had a 14.4 kilobits kilobaud modem, and then the next year, you know, we had like a 56k modem, and I realized I think people have trouble extrapolating things, you know, because I joke that, you know, my friends didn't really understand the internet back then. And then they understood it as soon as I showed them Napster, which eventually came BitTorrent, by the way, but Napster. And I showed them, you know, name any song, and I'd type it in and I'd start downloading it. And this is just, you know, at the cusp of when you were able to like download a song and like be able to start playing it right away. I guess what I'm trying to say is that I saw that as soon as it started to scale, I said, oh, well, pretty soon we'll be able to send any amount of information from anywhere to anywhere instantly at almost no cost. And people were like, so? And I was like, that's going to change everything. You know how hard it is to send around information instantly right now? So I think it's very difficult for people to extrapolate out into the future and see, you know, what can be, what could be. And I think that really is an important phenomenon to take note of here.
Yeah, and it's particularly difficult for human brains to do that with exponential technologies, just because we're not equipped really to handle, to understand the, you know, once you go through several exponential increases, our brains just like, we're linear thinkers.
Yeah, it's a bigger number, like, right?
You can't really conceive. Yeah, I was talking with Gigi about this actually when we went through his 21 lessons. And it, like, you just can't conceive of the like the numbers that are involved on with elliptic curve cryptography. The best, right? Like, you just
the
can't
best
conceive.
We can conceive of it is that we can't conceive of it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like numbers that are larger than the number of atoms in the universe. You know, it's like, or whatever. It's just, it's insane. And same kind of concept applies to understanding how an exponential technology will grow over time, become like scale over time and become adopted over time. But we've seen many, many exponential technologies, many examples over the past, you know, 100 years or so, from telephones to radios, televisions, refrigerators, AC, all the way up to, you know, the web technologies and computing technologies. So we have many examples of exponential technologies and how they scale, and they follow this S curve of adoption and all of that. So we can foresee that for sure. I think the harder to kind of forecast side of Bitcoin's monetization process is, you know, how we transition from one money to the other money, like just politically and socially, you know, and that's that we don't really have an example of to look at from history. So it's, you know, that's the really interesting sort of unknown part that we're heading into, and it's going to be a fascinating couple of decades for sure.
Yeah, I 100% agree.
Yeah, man. All right. You get to, I've been excited to ask you this question. So let's finish up. I want to hear your answer to the, what does Bitcoin look like in 50 years? Bitcoin future.
Man.
Just for some, to end with some fun and speculation.
50 years? Good Lord.
We have 50 years.
You know, we underestimate 5 years and, or no, we overestimate 5 years and we underestimate 15 years, I think they say. 50 years is almost completely off limits. There's been very few people that can predict that far in advance. And I think the few that have are the ones that we remember. And, that, you know, the millions of people that predicted incorrectly, we quickly forget.
Yeah. I'm definitely not going to hold you to it. And I don't expect you to be anywhere close to correct. Okay. But it's just, yeah, just a fun thought experiment.
What I do really think is that's unavoidable is the reduction in the size of government. I think that government for millennia have been propped up by the ability to print money. And I think if that power is usurped from them by the people simply choosing to use a different money, you know, I talk about, you know, fiat money has value because of government decree, but Bitcoin has value because people choose to use it, you know. What would you value more, something that people are choosing or ones that governments are telling us to use? So if we take that power away from them, I think we give the power back to the individual. And I think, you know, this idea of the sovereign individual may actually start to proliferate a little bit, that we don't need the government to necessarily control everything for us, or, you know, just that, I think smaller government in general, maybe it was government. We needed government to manage the supply of money, you know, in the modern age, because gold was such a poor medium of exchange. You know, I've heard pushback from Eric Voskill on that, saying that, oh, well, private industry could have, you know, minted their own coins and, you know, free banking. But I think this idea of uninflatable money is so groundbreaking. I think we'll see, you know, I think as Michael Goldstein puts it, just like an explosion of prosperity, of innovation. Mm-hmm. I think we'll see falling prices, which I think is a good thing. I think we'll see less malinvestment. We'll see less consumerism, and we'll see more sound investment. We'll see, you know, businesses that stand the test of time. We'll see families that stand the test of time. And I think that sounds like a good thing to me.
Yeah, just collectively shifting humanity's time preference from this sort of short time preference that we're locked into now by the kind of money we use, and being freed from that and able to think long term is like, yeah, it's going to change things from a very fundamental level and create a Bitcoin renaissance. I am totally down with that. I think that's certainly a possible outcome of Bitcoin, and like if it's allowed, you know, if it, I think it's almost a certain outcome at this point if Bitcoin does achieve, you know, kind of what I think of it as its goal to replace the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency, and yeah, just have an economy that's based on sound money again would be a beautiful thing. Imagine harnessing all of that productivity increase instead of having it sort of skimmed off the top by and then malinvested, you know, into assets as a store of value that don't need to be acting as a store of value. They're only acting that way because we don't have money that does it anymore. That'll change everything. So it's beautiful.
I had a thought. I think I just lost it, but what did you just say? Got me onto it. I lost it, man. Fleeting thoughts.
Happens. Yep. All right, man. Anything else you want to, any other thoughts you want to share with the listeners? You want to, anything you want to shill?
No, I just,
I did drop your Twitter handle. Mr. Cool BP.
MRCOOLBP at Twitter. And I just remembered it.
Oh, right on.
Essentially, that, you know, a lot of Bitcoiners talk about either Bitcoin will succeed or it will fail. It won't. I don't think it'll partially succeed. And that's because of the, you know, the incentive to adopt it because of its rising price due to its limited supply. So, you know, I don't think we'll ever see this stagnation of Bitcoin. It'll either succeed or it fails. And if it succeeds, you know, I think many of us think that it will lead to prosperity. And if it fails, I love this idea, and I certainly wasn't the one to think of it. It was really about the friends we've met along the way. And I got to tell you, I think it's a South Park quote, but I've heard a Bitcoiner mention it before. And I got to tell you, man, like, some of the people I've met in Bitcoin are just the most incredible. I mean, people that just really want really good things for society, and they don't want to rob from other people. They want good things for everybody. You know, they want prosperity, and they're just brilliant people like yourself and all the people that I've met. I mean, I could list them all off, you know, but it would be like a thinking Jesus speech at an award show. So I think I'll just leave you all with that. But
yeah,
but really, I mean, I it's a win-win for me, you know. Even if it goes to zero and we never speak of it again, the people that I met along the way are invaluable.
Yeah, it is an incredible community, and I had the chance to go to Bitcoin 2019 in San Francisco and meet some of these people in real life after several years of learning from them. And man, like that, these people just blew me away. Just how kind and approachable and thoughtful they were. You know, I had great conversations with everyone from Pierre Rochard, who is one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. I mean, that's like, seriously, super, awesome. Super kind man. And all the way to Adam Back, who like was standing outside of an after party one night as I was going to catch a lift. And I was like, hey, what's up, Adam Back? How's it going? And just chatted with Adam Back for a while. Super nice guy. Really funny. You know, it's just, yeah, full of really cool people. And it's been a lot of fun.
If you guys get to go to that conference, Brady put out a great episode. Actually, I think it was like two episodes where he kind of like tried to give you a glimpse into what the conversations were like behind the scenes at the conference. And it was really awesome for me because I wasn't able to make it. So thank you. Thank you for all you do, Brady.
Oh, cool, man.
I really appreciate your pod. I really appreciate your default Keynesianism. I think that's crucial to understanding this thing.
Oh, I appreciate that, man. And thanks to you too, man. It's, you know, there's so many Bitcoiners out there that, just, you know, are super smart, super thoughtful, have obviously put in a lot of time studying this stuff and putting out, you know, those concise thoughts onto Twitter. And that's one of the things I love about Twitter. It sort of forces you to distill everything you've learned from these source texts and taken in from all these podcasts and audiobooks and conversations into, you know, some concise, like, outline
form.
Kind of
make it a meme. You're forced to meme it. Yeah.
Exactly. And there's just so many brilliant Bitcoiners out there doing that. And I want to focus on this podcast, trying to bring in more of those sort of like underfollowed Bitcoiners to have these kind of conversations, just a couple of Bitcoiners sitting down to talk about Bitcoin and get some of those new voices into the scene, from, you know, the less well-known guys. And, so I'm really glad that you took some time to join me today. And I hope everyone who's listening will follow Mr. Cool BP on Twitter. Definitely a worthy follow, and you won't regret that. So thanks again, man. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, man. I'm super humbled to be here. So I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care, Ben.
You too.
All right, that was a good time. What did you all think of the conversation? What questions or thoughts did we surface today? Let us know on Bitcoin Twitter. Ben is at Mr. Cool BP, at MRCOOLBP, and I am, of course, at Citizen Bitcoin. If you appreciate this podcast, you can give back and help me out by sharing the episode with your friends and family and on Bitcoin Twitter, or leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Really appreciate all your support. That's it for this one. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.